complicated. There's ways around that. There's ways you can make it better and better. Once you recognize that on your outdoor antenna range, and almost every HF and VHF antenna range is an outdoor antenna range, because unless you're willing to spend more than $60 million building your anechoic chamber, unless you're willing to spend more than that amount of money, your anechoic chamber probably has good performance from 500 megahertz and above, and very degraded performance as you go below 500 megahertz to make the pyramids on the wall of an anechoic chamber big enough so they have enough wavelength of altitude so if they're a good absorber at, let me pick a number, 100 megahertz or 50 megahertz is out of the question. You just can't build anechoic material with pyramids that big and have them survive for any length of time. So you're going to be doing your outdoor VHF, HF antenna measurements on a reflective outdoor antenna range. And if you follow the requirements of Dr. Dick Turin, WQIMU, and by way of the ARRL antenna book, let me drop it. By way of the ARRL antenna book, you go to the section called Transmission Lines and Antenna Measurement. Why they combine those two, I don't know. At the back end of that chapter, you'll see this diagram by Dr. Dick Turin as to how you can live with the reflective ground of an outdoor antenna range. Instead of trying to fight the ground, you use the ground in your favor because it is so deterministic, because you can predict exactly where the reflection is going to happen on your ground plane antenna range, outdoor antenna range. You can use that in your favor. You properly adjust the altitude of the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, and you can make some beautiful measurements in the presence of ground plane reflection. And you take the world's best antenna range that I know of, the Romare Development Center near Utica, New York, and I've worked there for a good fraction of a year on a couple of occasions. When it comes to measurements below roughly 500 megahertz, where they've got this antenna range stuck between two mountains that are a mile and a half apart, and you put your transmitting antenna on one mountain top and your receiving antenna on the other mountain top, and you got a bunch of fiber optic cables going between the two, controlling signal generators and the receivers and whatever. When you go below 500 megahertz on that world's best antenna range, they use the parking lot because they know it's got a nice flat reflector that's thoroughly predictable. They're using the Dick Turin technique. So antenna testing is kind of funny. So to try to absolutely confirm with very high accuracy what is the effective capture area of your antenna, you got to be a little bit careful. As long as you're willing to accept an answer that's 90% correct, then the direct measurement will give it to you. You try to get that last 10% of accuracy, you got to be awful careful. KC2PYT for any other comments.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2PYT, I am done. You have run a question to my satisfaction, so I'll let you go ahead.
Yeah, once again, you talked a little bit too loud, Ed. I heard everything you said, but just for the hell of it, repeat your last message, but speak a little bit further from the mic so you're lower in volume. I want to see the experiment. You got it, Ed.
My apologies. I had turned down the mic gain a little bit, and I was hoping that would have taken care of it. Is this better?
Fantastically better. Not one single dropout during that transmission. All previous transmissions, every other syllable was a dropout because you had too much audio. You were going beyond the limits of this repeater, therefore it was dropping you out, Ed. Do remember to use that particular volume setting. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who was answering, and I still didn't get to the potentiometer discussion. Let's go to the mailbag. What I'm planning to do is go to the mailbag, the space report, and by the way, there was a beautiful launch this week where the spacecraft tried to land itself back on the barge, which didn't quite work, but they made progress in that direction. So I'm going to go to mailbag, space report, and then for you guys that want to hear about potentiometers, which is a very valuable tool, I'm going to give you a talk on that one. KC2WGB. Are they going to stump us again this week, John? K2RIW in the second net. You got it, John.
AC2MVP for a quick one.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, you had mentioned antenna effective capture area. Now, let me put this to you. Would that be considered one of those forms of antenna efficiency? Just a quick yes or no.
Wow. Okay. Because antenna efficiency has got about three different definitions, Steve, I'm sort of asking, if I'm measuring antenna effective capture area, could I use that to confirm standing wave efficiency, polarization efficiency, main lobe efficiency? The answer is sort of yes if you know what you're doing. I would much rather see you measure antenna efficiency if it's a power loss due to heating. Let me drop. If it's the kind of inefficiency that's caused by power loss due to heating, I'd much rather see you measure that with your hand or with an anechoic or with a thermal imaging camera. In other words, if I just built a Yagi and I've got some doodads on it, gimmick capacitors or whatever, and I want to find out, are they inefficient? The quickest way I can find out is to pour 100 watts into the antenna for 2 minutes, turn off the transmitter, run over there and touch everything. If everything on that antenna is ice cold, by definition, it is 100% efficient as a radiator. Now, if I want to measure main lobe efficiency, I've got to measure the three-dimensional antenna pattern. If I want to measure visual efficency, I've got to use a good vector network analyzer or antenna analyzer or a good visual meter. So, and now, could I now confirm the antenna efficiency by way of area? Yes, you could. It's the hard way to go, and depending on which one of the efficiencies you're measuring, you could do it that way, Steve. Very rarely is it done that way. Antenna area is quite often only a calculation. If you know the gain and you know the formula, you know the real area that had to be there in order to get that gain. So that's the more conventional way. So as a scientist, you could do it that way, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes, I'm just, you've mentioned the three or four different terms of efficiency. Let's just take SWR efficiency. Now, that antenna would have to be resident, correct? If that antenna was non-resident, I would not get SWR efficiency. Is that correct?
No. If I put a 50-ohm resistor, an RCO7 50-ohm resistor with its leads, at the tail end of your transmission line, and if I mounted it correctly, I can measure a standing wave ratio very close to 1-to-1. If I now do a transmitting and receiving antenna test, the leakage of the leads and the physical dimensions of that resistor is an antenna. It's probably got a gain of minus 25 dB. But it is an antenna. So the fact that I've measured good standing wave ratio doesn't mean I've got a good antenna. That's going to have a very small effective area because of 25 dB of gain, negative gain. As crazy as that sounds, the towel bar antenna that goes down to 20 megahertz, that's mounted on the vertical stabilizer, left side and right side, two separate antennas, on the EA-6B standoff jammer, aircraft, EA-6B aircraft, Navy aircraft, carrier mounted, let me drop it. On the vertical stabilizer, on the left side, on the right side, is something called a towel bar antenna. It really is a 50-ohm connector going to a long rod. I'm guessing the rod is about 2 feet long, and the far end of that rod is terminated with a 50-ohm resistor. It is a leaky 50-ohm resistor on the end of that transmission line. It happens to have a gain at the low end, 20 megahertz, of minus 22 dB. I've measured it. But because it's listening to very potent signals down there, that amount of low gain is perfectly acceptable. That antenna gives you a beautiful standing wave ratio. A towel bar antenna is a very respected antenna. It's low in gain, beautiful on visual, low in efficiency. Of all the power you put into that antenna, 99% of it is turned into heat. 1% of it's radiated. That's what minus 20 dB of gain means. But for its purpose, It does the job beautifully. You try to design an antenna that covers multiple octaves starting at 20 megs and going up, and having a low standing wave ratio to give you defined receiver performance. You try to design a direct antenna to do that. You and I got some idea as to how big a dipole is at 20 meters, 20 megacycles. That's 15 meters, but you know what I mean. You're never going to squeeze that onto the vertical stabilizer of a Navy airplane, carrier-mounted airplane. That antenna does the job. So, as you can tell, measuring VISRA, measuring gain, they're two completely separate characteristics, and one affects the other, but not in a direct manner from that example I just gave you. KC2MDP, good question. K2RIW, good, Steve.
Question.
Yes, Dick. Very good. The more you give me, that was a perfect example. I understand that 100%. That yes, you can have an extremely low SWR, such as a dummy load, but it's not an efficient radiator. I appreciate it, Dick. I am going to have to read up on this, and like you said, it all seems to be how you want to look at the term efficiency. Back to you.
There's lots of kinds of efficiency. You got it, Wes, into XJN, K2RIW.
A very interesting subject you're discussing, guys, and because of this subject, I have a few questions. What would you say about electromagnetic wave pressure versus the distance? And if you could derive something with the parts of the electromagnetic wave, the pressure of electrical field or pressure of magnetic field. And to you.
Yeah. I sometimes try to be a smart guy. And one of my crazy statements is a smart guy knows what he doesn't know. I've got no experience at calculating wave pressure. Yes, an RF wave. Yes, the solar wind coming out of the sun. The 550 nanometer, tremendous amount of energy coming out of the sun. I know they've got a radiation pressure. And I know if I look up enough Google websites, I'll probably find some formulas that'll tell me how to do that. I know that wave pressure is very small. I know that when NASA has proposed to build a solar sail on their spacecraft, I know they talk about the square miles of area to try to get enough pressure out of it. And I know that, calculate how to build a structure that can fold inside of the cylinder, the radome, so to speak, of a rocket that's on your launch pad, and all that stuff folds up inside, and when it goes out into space, it unfolds itself and deploys and becomes square miles of solar reflector area in order to get enough thrust. That's a serious engineering problem. So, solar pressure, radio pressure, I know it's there. I know in general it's extremely small. So it's almost an academic discussion. And the best example I can think about that is that for 35 solid years, they were doing a very careful calculation because of the way the Deep Space Network of National Aeronautics and Space Administration, because of the way that hardware works as a transponder, where you literally count every single cycle that goes up to the spacecraft, and you can count every single cycle that comes back down. And therefore, you know range and range rate with extremely high accuracy. Even though your spacecraft is a million or a billion miles away, you have range resolution of a couple of feet and range rate revolution of a couple of feet per second. Let me drop. You're doing this beautiful experiment of sending the Voyager out there into space. And they thought this would be a great way of confirming 4, 5, 6, 7 more decimal places of the astronomical unit. Because they know how fast they launched it, they know how much energy it picks up every time it does a flyby of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And so they were continuously for 35 years calculating the position and range rate of Voyager. And they kept coming up with an error. The damn thing was slowing down faster than it was supposed to. The difference was very small, but their equipment was so damn accurate it could resolve that. and it bugged the daylights out of them. They kept saying, well, maybe we don't really know what is the length of the astronomical unit, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And I said, well, Voyager seems to be violating that a little bit. Now, it's in the fourth decimal place or whatever, but it keeps violating it by a very measurable amount. But we can't have the astronomical unit wrong. We can't have the gravity constant wrong. Otherwise, the Earth wouldn't be in this particular orbit around the Sun. And so all the other planets wouldn't be in that particular orbit. And what finally was resolved a year or two ago is they finally discovered that all of the heat being given off by that onboard nuclear generator that's running all that electronics, the electronics is giving off heat, the generator is giving off heat, but all of that stuff is on the backside of the parabolic dish. All of that infrared radiated energy for all of those years was reflecting off the back of the dish, and 99.99% of the time, Voyager always sits with that dish precisely aimed at Earth, because that's the only way we can talk to the damn thing. Any job? Said all of that thermal energy radiating off the back of the parabolic dish on Voyager was essentially an extremely low ionic engine, so to speak, blasting in the wrong direction, slowing it down. And that was the explanation. When they finally figured out what was going on, when they measured the amount of thermal energy that they know is dissipating, and they compared that to the slowdown rate that they experienced with the Deep Space Network, they said, aha, the numbers track. So, radio energy, does it have pressure? Absolutely. Is it an amount of pressure that you and I care about? Almost never. It is damn small. I don't know how to calculate it, but I know that there are references out there by which you can do it. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Actually, it's not that important to calculate, but it's to understand it. Could we increase the pressure, like the pressure of air in the container? Could we monitor and eventually alter the pressure? The generation of radiation pressure comes, of course, from the fact that we have a momentum property of photons, and those are changing the momentum when the incident radiation strikes the surface. So we are, the way that I understand it is, we have an empty space. We don't know the photon is there. We have no idea. We cannot even find the photon there unless it strikes something. So, in one of our materials that I have published, I postulated that we need the mass in order to find out what is actually the empty space. But we have a certain distance from the transmitter, from the antenna, and we want to know what is the pressure of the electromagnetic wave 10 feet, 20 feet, 1 mile away. Of course, we have a near field, we have a far field, whatever, but we need to know that. So I hoped that based on you working with anaconic chamber, you would be able to get some more information. Let me drop. We have seen that electromagnetic waves carry energy, that's given, that's normal. Okay. But also the electromagnetic wave has a momentum. And that is actually the argument of Einstein. He was actually trying to make a model of railroad car with the mass and length, and then he was saying, okay, we have electromagnetic wave of total energy E, and is emitted from one out of the car. Then it propagates along the car, and then is absorbed at the other end. So then he was able to calculate the effective mass of this radiation by MC, M equals E divided by C squared. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to end this one now, Wes, because radiation pressure in your and my laboratory, 99.99% of the time, it is my guess, it is so damn small that if you ignored it, your experiment from that factor is not going to have an error in the fourth or fifth decimal place.
Yeah, but a question for you.
The
do we have actually in space? Do we have a presence of electric field? And a magnetic field is only present in near field. But that would propagate electric field, especially because of a dual nature of the photon. And then when it strikes there, then we get all of the components back. See, the problem that I'm having, trying to turn that to academic discussions, because of Maxwell was that, I'm going to read it, this velocity is so new that of light that it seems that we have a strong reason to conclude that light itself, including radiant heat and other radiations, if any, is an electromagnetic disturbance in form of waves propagated through the electromagnetic field according to the electromagnetic laws. And to exchange.
A radio wave, a light wave, it does have an extremely small amount of momentum. It's got a significant amount of energy, but an extremely small amount of momentum. Therefore, it does have a radiation pressure, yes. And the method by which many people think they're seeing radiation pressure is by using that device called a radiometer. A radiometer is this toy-like thing that many of us have seen, which is a round bulb of around 4 inches in diameter. And inside there are three or four blades, where each one of the blades are silvered on one side and black on the other side. And you shine sunlight on it, you shine your flashlight on it, and you watch it rotate. And you say, yeah, I'm seeing radiation pressure. Good example. Dead wrong. You study what that thing is doing. Because a radio wave, or an electromagnetic wave, bouncing off the silver surface, is going in, hitting, and coming back out, bouncing off the silver surface. That's twice as much momentum as when it hits the black surface, where it hits and gets absorbed. Therefore, it should always turn so that the silver side moves away from the source of light. And you sit and study your radiometer, and you realize it always turns in the wrong direction. The black-sided blades are the ones that move away. You think the thing is measuring radiation pressure? Absolutely not. Let me drop. You study the method by which you build a radiometer, and you discover that the radiometer works best when you have just the right amount of air pressure, a partial vacuum, inside of that bulb. What's happening is that the light hits the black side, the light gets absorbed by the black side becomes slightly heated by about 1 degree Fahrenheit. The air molecules that are in there bouncing all over the place, when they hit the black side, which is hotter, they move away faster. So it's the light, it's the air molecules bouncing off the black side, and not bouncing as fast off the silver side, that makes it move. You take that radiometer and you put it inside of a hard vacuum, it will not rotate. You build a radiometer with hard vacuum and you try to shine a flashlight on it strong enough to make it rotate. You might not be able to do it. It gives you a strong example of real radiation pressure is a damn small number. So that radiometer is not measuring radiation pressure. It's measuring the way air molecules bounce when they hit a warm surface versus a cold surface. So that, to me, is a beautiful example of the fact that radiation pressure is an extremely small number. I defy you to make a radiometer with a high vacuum and shine a bright enough light on it that you can make it rotate without melting the glass. I give you that challenge. You might not be able to do it. Over to you for a comment on that one, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, you've touched the right point. The confusion comes from the fact that the electromagnetic wave is made out of two components, the electric field and magnetic field. And then when we're talking about the pressure of electromagnetic wave, then we say, okay, what is the pressure, what is the pressure, magnetic part of that pressure? And then in two results, that is energy density that is associated with magnetic field. So any magnetic field has an associated magnetic pressure contained in the boundary of conditions of the field. And in terms of electromagnetic wave, it is as far as it goes. By that token, I have a problem with you saying that it's minimal, it's small, unless we come to the conclusion that we don't have a magnetic field. As we have an electromagnetic wave. Yes, magnetic wave, electromagnetic wave, that has the two components, but actually that's what travels. It's only the electric field. The magnetic field is not present in space when the electromagnetic field wave travels. So that's the part of the confusion that I have. Enter it here.
Okay, there's a problem in what you just said, Wes. The classic way that electromagnetic wave is taught, the way it propagates through space, is called the pointing vector. The energy of the wave is called the magnitude of the pointing vector. The pointing vector is derived by doing a cross product called E cross H. If your wave is vertically polarized, and you start off with your hand, your thumb is pointing in the direction of the wave, your fingers are pointing in the direction of the E field, they're pointing toward the ceiling at 12 o'clock, and then you rotate your hand from 12 o'clock toward 3 o'clock, where you're doing E cross H. The H is at 3 o'clock, horizontally polarized. The E is vertically polarized at 12 o'clock. And you rotate E cross H. That's what the cross vector is. That product, that vector product, is called pointing vector. That is the energy of that electromagnetic wave in the classic way it's taught. Is the energy of the electromagnetic wave, is it E field energy or H field energy? The answer is yes, by way of the pointing vector. That is the energy, that is the wave, that gives it the momentum, that gives it the radiation pressure. So I don't accept you saying that the pressure is due to the E field or the pressure is due to the H field. It's the product of the two as a cross product of that E cross H pointing vector. We've got to move on now, Wes. We're never going to settle this one. John, go to the mailbag, please. KC2WJB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone joining the net here. It's a fun. I think, Dick, what we should do is take Vito's question as a mailbag question, and that's an important question and good application. Also, maybe you'd want to speak about that in both terms of an active product and a passive product, you know, depending on whether it's used to control bias or handle the signal itself. But a great subject. So what do you think of that? KC2WGB, back to you.
Well done, John. You burned your keep. Yeah, Vito 2 weeks ago was replacing a defective potentiometer in one of his radios. And the original
field strength meter, I believe, Dick.
Okay. So wherever his potentiometer was being used, it could have been the volume control in a radio. It could have been the so-called volume control on that standing wave ratio meter. It almost doesn't matter. And by the way, there's two, three, four different ways you can use a potentiometer. But let's talk about the more classic way first. Let me drop. Assuming that I got an old-fashioned tube radio where the final detecting stage takes the amplitude modulated IF signal, it got there by way of the super heterodyning technique of the RF amplifier and mixer up front. So your 1 megacycle and winds 1010 New York signal went into the RF amplifier, went into the mixer, got mixed down to 455 KC. After a few stages of amplification of the IF strip at 455 KC, the signal came out of the final detector. It might have been a 6L5 tube in the old days. Anyhow, the final detector has now got a audio signal, which maybe is a fraction of a volt, a fraction of a volt audio signal by way of capacitive coupling from that detector rectifier is fed into the top of, in the old days, a half mega ohm potentiometer. So the top of the potentiometer has got the audio signal, the bottom of the potentiometer is grounded, and the slider of the potentiometer goes to a capacitive coupling circuit into the first audio amplifier. So as you rotate that volume control, when the pointer of the volume control, the potentiometer, is down near ground, you're getting no signal. As you rotate it toward the top, you get the full signal coming out of the rectifier of that radio, and you get full volume. And in between, you get everything in between. It's a very proportional device, if and only if it is a linear tapered potentiometer, and if it's going into the very high impedance device called control grid of the audio amplifier tube. Let me drop. Now, in that particular example, where the audio amplifier might have a control grid input impedance that is, let me pick a number, 10 megohms, and it might be 100 megohms. It's a very high impedance, as long as it's a non-gassy tube. And the half megohm potentiometer represents very little load to the rectifier, and that circuit works like a charm. And you find out that your potentiometer is defective, and the only potentiometer you've got in your junk box happens to be 100 ohms, not half megohm. And you plug in 100 ohms, and you write down 100 ohms on the schematic diagram, and the schematic diagram, you look at the fact that the rectifier audio is going into the top of the potentiometer, the ground is still going to, the grounded end of the potentiometer still goes to ground, and the slider goes to the tube of the audio amplifier. It looks like it should work like a charm. It won't. And the reason for that is, in this particular example, the actual output impedance of your rectifier tube on the final end of that 455 KCIF strip, it might have an impedance of 10,000 ohms. And you're feeding it into a 100 ohm potentiometer. You're putting a 100 ohm load resistor on a 10,000 ohm source of audio signal. You're only going to get a couple of percent of the audio getting into that potentiometer, because as far as your rectifier tube is concerned, that's almost a short circuit. You'll hear a little bit of audio coming out when you crank the volume control up full blast, but you're not going to hear very much because you've overloaded it. Let me drop. So in that particular example, you can see how putting in something that's very wrong is going to give you only partial operation. If the original potentiometer was a half megohm, and many of them were in those days, and you picked up one that's 100K or 50K instead, it's going to work. You'll get a little bit less audio, but it's going to work. But and now, if you're feeding a milliammeter as part of a standing wave ratio meter, now that meter has got a much lower impedance than that the audio amplifier tube. Now you're going to tend to use a much lower impedance signal generating circuit, and you're going to be using a much lower impedance potentiometer. Maybe the original potentiometer was 5K, 1K, something along those lines. And could you put in a 100 ohm potentiometer? Yes, you're going to get partial operation, but you're also going to be killing some of the signal. Could you put a 10 ohm potentiometer? Probably not. You're going to get almost no operation. So the input impedance of the potentiometer is one factor you care about. There's another factor. Let me drop. And that is, every potentiometer has got an input impedance. It's also got an output impedance. They ain't the same. In the original example I gave of an audio amplifier circuit of a vacuum tube type radio, 1960 vintage type radio, 1955 type radio, half megohm input impedance, the potentiometer half megohm impedance from top to bottom gives very little loading of that rectifier tube, the 6L6 or whatever it was, that was developing the rectified audio coming off the 455 KC amplitude modulated signal in that IF strip. When the potentiometer was set in the center, let's assume now that my signal generator, for simplicity, that that rectifier tube, the 6L6 6AL5, I think is the tube that was sometimes used. Let's assume for a second that it had an output impedance of 0 ohms. It doesn't, but let's assume it does. If the output impedance of the source of signal going into the top of your potentiometer is 0 ohms output impedance, it's a nearly pure voltage generator, and the bottom of the potentiometer is grounded, and the potentiometer is set in the center. Now, let's look at it backwards. We're now standing at the center tap of the potentiometer, the slider. We see half of the impedance to ground, which is 250K ohms, and half the impedance from slider up, another 250K ohms. It's a 500K potentiometer, and I've got it set in the center. So I got 250K to ground, 250K to the top, which is a 0 ohm source impedance. I got a pair of 250Ks in parallel. I got 125 kilo ohms of output impedance when it's set at center. If I'm now putting a milliammeter repeater, timeout. If now I'm putting a milliammeter as the load on the center tap of that potentiometer, and there's ways that you and I can measure the impedance of a milliammeter, and you got to be careful how you do that. You your milliammeter might have a, if it's a 50 microamp movement, it might have an impedance of 1,000 ohms. To measure 1,000 ohms with your normal ohm meter, you set it on the times one scale, and the current coming out of your ohm meter is now going to put enough current into your 50 microamp per meter movement. Maybe it's going to put in 3 milliamps of current on a 50 microamp per meter movement. It's going to slam it against the peg so hard, you might bend the needle. So to measure the impedance of a milliammeter, that's an art and a science of itself. You can't, in many cases, do the direct measurement with an ohm meter. You want to know the ohms of your milliammeter, but you can't measure it with an ohm meter. What do? You set up a network of a battery, an adjustable resistor going into your milliammeter, and you adjust it so that you get full-scale deflection. Now you start putting a resistor from milliammeter to ground to shunt the signal that's going into the milliammeter, and you shunt it to the point where you get half-meter movement. It's called the half-voltage technique. If you've got a constant current generator going through a resistor, going into your device of unknown impedance, and you want to measure the device impedance, you put a resistor across the device in question to the point where you get half voltage, and now you know that the series resistor from the power supply that's feeding your meter and the shunt resistor you put from a meter to ground, you know they're equal to each other because you've now got half meter movement. Half voltage technique, it's called. Let me drop. And you could be measuring the millivolts across your milliammeter, by the way, with a sensitive voltmeter. In either case, you're getting half voltage or half current, so to speak. And now that resistor that caused that to happen, you take that out of the network and you measure it, and you might measure 1,000 ohms. So it's an indirect measurement so that you don't destroy your very sensitive microammeter. So what I'm getting at is every microammeter has got a real impedance. That impedance is being fed by the potentiometer. In the case of the potentiometer, I just used as an example, where it was a 500K pot, when the slider is in the center, the impedance of the output of that network is 250K. It's 125K. You take 125K source impedance, and you feed it into a 1K load, your milliammeter. You now can calculate what percentage of the energy potential you've got gets there. You've got an impedance mismatch. You got 125K source impedance network of that potentiometer feeding a 1K impedance called milliammeter. Turns out that would work because the meter is so darn sensitive, 50 microamps. It doesn't need all of the voltage, if you know what I mean. But there's other kinds of circuits you put there where you care about it. That's the simple calculation for what happens when the potentiometer is set in the center of its range. What happens is they start rotating the meter, the potentiometer, toward ground or toward the top. The impedance becomes lower. If I turn the potentiometer so I'm at the 10% setting, 10% setting really means that it's a 500K total pot, and therefore from slider to ground I've got 50K, and that really means that I've got the 450K from slider to the top. What is the real output impedance? It's 450K in parallel with 50K, and I guess the answer is going to turn out around 45K. So you can calculate the output impedance of any potentiometer depending on where it is set. It's a not too complicated chunk of electronics of putting two resistors in parallel. So as you can tell, that when you're using a potentiometer in the conventional manner, there's an ideal amount of total resistance of the potentiometer, and for both from two points of view. How much does it load down the circuit that's the source of the signal? Let me drop. And what impedance am I going to have in the output of the slider of the potentiometer feeding whatever I consider a load? If I'm now trying to feed a motor with the slider of the potentiometer, and maybe the armature impedance of my DC motor happens to be 10 ohms, in that case, you're not likely to use a 500K pot. In that case, you're probably going to use 100-ohm potentiometer, if you know what I mean. So there's an ideal impedance of potentiometer, which is a function of at least two things. What is the source impedance of my signal? what is the load impedance that my slider or my potentiometer is going to feed. But in all cases, the potentiometer is a voltage divider network. It's got a resistor. It's got a total resistor that you're feeding the top of, and the bottom you often ground. Sometimes you don't, but that's another whole case. And the slider is now what's giving you the reasonably proportional adjustment of output signal so that you've got the equivalent of a volume control or a sensitivity control. And so for each circumstance, there's an ideal impedance of potentiometer you should be using. And it's not an exact science. If your original AM tube type radio had a 500K pot, which was a value that was quite popular in those days, and you plug in a 100K pot instead, it's going to work. Plug in a 100 ohm pot, it's not going to work. You got some leeway, as you can tell. It's sort of similar to what happens when you're building a power supply. The schematic diagram called for a 50 microfarad filter capacitor, and the only thing you've got in your hand is a 150 microfarad filter capacitor. Is that going to work? Absolutely. It's going to work even a little bit better as long as it's got the right voltage rating. If they call for a 50 microfarad capacitor and the only thing you've got in your hand is a 5 microfarad capacitor, you're not going to get very good filtering. It's going to work. It's going to be kind of sloppy, and you're going to get some hum out of that power supply. So when it comes to choosing values of components that are replacing something that blew out on your situation, you can tell that you've got a range of components that will work as a temporary or semi-permanent manner, but there's an ideal value you should be using. And in case of a filter capacitor, more capacitance usually is good. There's a couple of examples where it might not be. The turn-on surge impedance of a power supply, if you've got a 2,000-volt power supply for your kilowatt transmitter, let me drop. And the filter capacitor is supposed to be 10 microfarads, and the only thing you've got in your hand is a 10,000 microfarad capacitor, okay? At the instant you flip on that switch, the current that flows through your diode rectifier network that's going to charge up the capacitor is going to be something huge. You take a rectifying high voltage diode that's rated for 3 amperes, and you feed it a surge impedance on turn on of 35 amperes. You look at the manufacturer's rating. For one or two cycles, it will tolerate 35 amperes, even though it's a 3 ampere rated diode. So if you're feeding a 10 microfarad capacitor, no problem. You're feeding a 10,000 microfarad capacitor. For that poor power supply rectifier network to charge that great big capacitor, it's not going to be doing it in one or two cycles. It's going to take 1,000 or 2,000 cycles to do it, in which case you're going to be putting 35 amperes not in there for one cycle, but you're going to be doing it for 1,000 cycles, and you're probably going to melt down that diode. So as long as you've got some way of doing a slow start of that power supply, the 10,000 microfarad capacitor would give you some beautiful filtering, but you now got to worry about startup current. That's another whole question. So let's go back to that potentiometer. As you can tell, a potentiometer used in the normal manner, let me drop. It is a continuously variable, selectable voltage divider network, which has a calculatable input impedance and a calculatable output impedance. But because you're putting voltage on the top of the pot, and you're usually grounding the bottom of the pot, if you're using it as a potentiometer, everything is pretty well defined mathematically. And whether or not your pot is too big or too small in the number of total ohms, and whether or not it's a linear taper, logarithmic taper, and the effect you get from that, these are all calculatable situations. Now, let's talk about what happens when seawater is pouring into your basement. The seawater gets up to, let me pick a number, knee high, and you suddenly realize you've got a whole lot of valuable photographs and record books in that basement, and you want to go wading in that basement to rescue your valuable materials. Boy, are you in trouble. You think all you got to do is worry about getting wet with seawater. Oh, boy. Probably have a number of electrical appliances in that basement. And if that seawater touches the hot plug or the hot terminal inside of one of those appliances, and now 120 volt or 240 volt power is being applied to the seawater somewhere in your basement. Somewhere else in your basement is a grounded object. It might be the copper tubing coming out of your oil tank. And your oil tank copper tubing goes over to the oil burner. The oil burner has got a three-prong plug to it, or the equivalent by way of the PX wiring, where it is grounded. That volumetric resistive material called seawater in your basement is a potentiometer. Depending on where, let me drop this. Depending on where the seawater got touched to the high voltage, depending on where the seawater got grounded by something in your basement that's grounded, and by the way, the grounded could also be the continuous amount of leakage of the seawater touching the concrete of the basement floor, and the seawater has been leaking into that basement floor, seeping through it, so to speak, through its cracks, and touching real earth. So you've got a number of ways that some portion of the seawater is being grounded, and some portion of the seawater is touching a hot terminal with 110 or 220 volts. And seawater is an extremely conductive material. It has a ohmic resistance of 0.2 ohm meter. In other words, if you started off with a fish tank that's a 1 meter cube, and you've got a left-hand sheet metal on the left-hand side of 1 square meter, and a sheet metal on the right-hand side of 1 square meter, and you fill up the tank with ordinary seawater, and you put your ohm meter, your AC ohm meter between the two, you'll measure 0.2 ohms. It's a highly conductive material. So, it's a volumetric conductive material, highly conductive. You got voltage at one end in the basement where it's touching an appliance. You got grounding somewhere in the basement in multiple places. It is a volumetric three-dimensional potentiometer. And now you go wading into that potentiometer. Let me drop. Extremely noisy signal from Hal, which I'll turn it over to you in a minute. So now that seawater, because the electric power is still activated in your basement where the seawater is pouring in, and now you're getting a voltage drop across that seawater. It's a conductive material. One end of it's got voltage, another end somewhere else in multiple places has got a ground, and you're standing in that seawater. And if you happen to be standing at right angles to that current flow to the seawater, where your left-hand leg, which has got close to a square meter or half a square meter of area, is near the high voltage side, and the right-hand leg is near the low voltage side, and let's assume now that the ground happens to be 10 meters away. So 10 meters away is the ground, and the total amount of seawater, now let's make it 1 meter. As you can tell, the voltage your left-hand leg is going to see and the voltage your right-hand leg is going to see can easily be a significant fraction of the 110 volts or the 220 volts that's being applied to the seawater. And it's a highly conductive material. And if now you calculate the impedance, like I was telling you, how you take the slider of the potentiometer and you now look backwards, you measure how many ohms to ground, how many ohms to the source, and that source of 110 volts, by the way, has got milliohms of impedance back to Con Edison or LIPA. Let me drop. So you've got a very low source impedance. You've got a very low equivalent impedance of potentiometer. You could call it a 1 ohm potentiometer, and your leg is the output impedance of that potentiometer is a very small number of ohms, and your two legs are across those two voltages of the two different taps. One leg is on one tap, and your other leg is the other tap of this virtual potentiometer of the seawater in your basement. The reason I'm saying this is because it is my belief of the 60 people who died of drowning, supposedly, during Superstorm Sandy in the New York City area during that storm, I am convinced a high percentage of them who died of drowning in their basement, and the water didn't come up to the ceiling of the basement, a high percentage of them drowned from electrocution, in my opinion. And you're now seeing some of the mechanism by which they can do it. That seawater as a potentiometer is an extremely small impedance potentiometer, which can put tremendous amounts of current between your left leg and your right leg, between your left arm and your right arm, if your arms are underwater. And once that large area of contact to your skin takes place, and it touches the blood supply that are in all those arteries and veins that are in your leg, and that current stops, and your blood, by the way, has got the same amount of conductivity of seawater. Let me drop. So that current flowing through your arteries and veins of your left leg flows up through your torso, through your heart, back down to the right hand, to the other leg. You can see you've got a kind of current flowing through your heart between left leg and right leg by way of the blood supply. And boy, can you easily be electrocuted in that environment. The bottom line of this is that if seawater is pouring into your basement, and you've got the slightest hint that there could be electrical power in that basement, no matter what is down there, I don't care if it's $1 million in green money, in $100 bills, I don't think you want to go there. There's a good chance you'll die if you do that. Okay, Hal wanted to make a comment on this. K6DPZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Hal. I can tell you in there, Hal, we heard half a syllable of your speech on four occasions. Half a syllable is all that got through. Either because the signal is weak or because the audio is too strong. I'm not sure which. In either case, you were 97% dropout. We heard half a syllable on four occasions. That's all we got. Try using less audio and more RF if possible, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. In the back pocket.
I can tell you lowered your audio volume, Hal, and this time we got about four words on four different occasions. So as you lowered your audio with this very weak RF signal, you dropped out 60% of the time, and I could hear your call letters. That's all I got out of that. You either need more RF and quite a bit less audio, maybe you'll get through. As you talk, each time you talk, you drop out. K6DPZ, K2LIW.
And there's K2LIW.
K6DPZ, K2LIW. Sorry, Hal. That was pure dropout. We got nothing out of it. We heard the beginning of your call letters. That's all we heard. So until you get into a better location, I'd like to hear what you're going to say, but you're not making it tonight, sorry to say. There must be some other way you can transmit to us. Maybe you're at your new location and the antenna is not on the building yet. So, as you can tell, that's a potentiometer used as a potentiometer. You can also use a potentiometer as a rheostat. In other words, you feed your source of signal into the top of the potentiometer, and the slider becomes the output as a series variable resistor that goes into your load, and the bottom end, the potentiometer, is not used at all. In that case, again, there's an ideal value of potentiometer to be used. So an extremely useful device. It teaches me a lot about seawater and drowning and electrocution. It also teaches me an awful lot about the way audio amplifiers work and the way standing wave ratio meters work. Here we go. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I'll bet you, at times, I'll bet John, you've had the choice of a blown potentiometer or an intermittent or noisy potentiometer, and you want to replace it, and sometimes you don't have the exact value that was in the original circuit, and you wonder if the one in your hand is going to do the job. But you've been there before. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, Dick, many times. There was one job I remember well because I had to use two stacked potentiometers and wire them up so that they would work as one, just to increase the value a little bit because we had some problems. And there were two different pods, but it did work out well. Okay, I think we should go over to the space report because it's 11 after 11 already, and we want to get that worded from Paul. So back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
I would have a comment.
Okay, Wes, don't make it too long, but you got it.
Yeah, well, you're talking about possibility of being electrocuted in the salt water in the basement. Yes, you could. But the number of currents that's lost through your body is in equation only a part of the thickness of the conductor. And we're dealing with density of the seawater and temperature of the seawater in terms of conductivity. So one of the examples would be is that if you have a wire that goes directly to the ground and you have 100 amps at 200 volts, it goes through that wire, and you touch that wire and you'll be on your bare foot also touching the ground. Now, the resistance of your body, actually we're talking about the impedance of your body versus the impedance of the copper wire is going to direct to the ground is a huge difference. It's like you have two resistors connected in parallel. At the point, only the fraction of the current will go through your body, you wouldn't probably never feel that. So when you deal with the water reservoir that you have a flowing current through it, then you have a per square footage area based on density and based on temperature and based on conductivity of that fluid, current spread. I would say is that if you are only the one conductor, would be like you trying to push with the force of 1 kilogram the needle through your hand. But if you are not the one, then I would say that this is comparable to you are trying to push a pen to the other side, lift up through your hand. You're feeling the pressure, but nothing is going to happen to your hand. And to Adrian.
Wesley, if I take the bottom line of what you just told me, are you telling me that if I go into the seawater of my basement when the electric power is turned on, that I'm relatively safe because I'm a high impedance? Is that what you're saying? I hope that's not what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you try to compare you being only the one part of the electric current and you being in the salt water, then you are only in the salt water, in the reservoir, only the part of the component or the equation that is present there. That means that current goes only at the easiest part. When it does have the lowest of the impedance or the resistance, depends on what current we're dealing with. And to Adrian.
Okay, let me ask you a direct yes or no question. If I enter the seawater in my basement when the electric power is turned on, are you telling me most of the time I am safe because I'm high impedance? Is that what you're saying? Yes or no?
No, you're not safe. No, the answer is no. What I'm saying is the probability of the strength of the electrocution that you get in the salt water is lesser than the probability of you dying when you are not in the salt water but the current is going through your body.
Okay, with what people usually know about human impedance, what you just said makes common sense. I'm convinced it's dead wrong, and I'll show you why. If I grab the two probes on my ohmmeter, which happens to have alligator clips on the end, and I grab those two alligator clips between my left hand and my right hand, with my fingers of reasonable amount of dryness, I will measure half a megohm to my left hand and my right hand. I could easily make the impedance, I can make the mistake of saying, I'm a high impedance load, I'm not going to draw much current, therefore I'm reasonably safe when I enter the seawater. Reasonable sounding. I did the next experiment. I took two relatively large oval-shaped bowls that my wife happens, they happen to be aluminum bowls, and I made phony seawater by pouring table salt into the seawater, into the tap water of each of these two bowls. So I made an oval-shaped bowl of phony seawater out of table salt poured into tap water, which, by the way, when I measured the impedance, it was higher than seawater, but that's another function. I made these pair of aluminum bowls, and I stuck my left hand arm and my right hand arm in the two bowls. My left hand arm means that from my elbow to my wrist, I could squeeze it into one bowl, and most of that arm was under the water, and the same thing with the right.